Welcome to Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Our program using the Zoom platform, pre-recorded on a Monday, October 4th, for playback on Thursday, October 7th, and the show to be aired on WFSU-FM, also archived on WFSU.org. If you would allow me just a moment of personal privilege, because as we're recording this today, we just became aware of the tragic and unfortunate passing of a very good friend, Tallahassee Fire Department Lieutenant and Public Information Officer Sarah Cooksey. In addition to her many responsibilities with the fire department, Sarah was also the driving force behind Pink Heels. She and a group of compadres put together a campaign whereby they would show up at hospitals and other caregiving facilities in a pink fire truck and all donned pink firefighting gear, the helmets and the raincoats and all of that. And they would come running in as if they were on a fire call, but they would then gather around a cancer patient's bed or wherever else they were in the facility, and just lift their spirits and bring them little gifts and words of encouragement. It was an absolutely marvelous outreach, and that was Sarah's doing, and she is no longer with us. And as we embark upon this month of October, which is nationally recognized as Breast Cancer Awareness Month, our thanks going out to Sarah Cooksey for the terrific legacy and the memories that she has left in her wake. Well, back to that subject, though. Of course, COVID-19 has led to decreases and delays in identifying new cancers, and it has also impacted the delivery of treatment and has only compounded the complexity of taking care of this very devastating illness here, and especially with the racial disparities and the late-stage cancer diagnosis issues that we're going to be talking about today. There's just so much that we have to get to, and we don't want to delay that anymore. So let's meet our panel, and we'll get into a discussion of the resources and the treatments and the protocols that are available and how all this works in our current COVID situation, if you will. First, let's meet Terlisa Shepherd, metastatic breast cancer patient advocate and an author also of Unbreakable Spirit, Rising Above the Impossible. Terlisa, thank you so much for joining us. Can't wait to hear more about that book of yours.
Thank you, Tom.
We say hi to Dr. Luis Reyes, president of the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Reyes, thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, sir. We have Megan Hall, who's Senior Director of Medical Communication at Grail. That's a company pioneering Galeri, a multi-cancer early detection test that can detect over 50 types of cancers. And certainly, Megan, we want to hear how that impacts the diagnosis of breast cancer in particular, but also the larger situation. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And we have a very noted physician, a surgeon in Panama City, Florida, for a quarter of a century, founding president of Advanced Urology Institute and the Bay Regional Cancer Center. He also happens to be the representative of the U.S. House of Representatives in Florida's 2nd Congressional District, and that is Congressman Neil Dunn. We should call you Dr. Dunn today, I guess, huh, Congressman?
Please do. I go by doctor in Washington. It's good to be with you again, Tom.
It is so good to see you, sir, and thanks for joining the panel here. Well, could we start with you, Dr. Reyes? What is the current state, before we get into diagnosis and all, but the current state of mortality when it comes to breast cancer? I think all of us know someone who perhaps has passed on as a consequence of this situation. What is the current mortality rate, and how are treatments coming along for the illness?
No, it has been very exciting years because we have, in the last 10 years, discovered a lot of biomarkers and genes responsible for the cancer, to the point that the treatment for breast cancer and other cancers is now targeted, we call pinpoint, rational, And that has come with the approval of several new target agents for breast cancer that have increased tremendously the survival of the patient. The only thing that happened, that's why I don't like when the patients go to the internet, is our SEER national database takes 4 or 5 years to update themselves. So that's why when I tell my patients, don't worry about the thing, because this database is updated after thousands of patients get treated. So you don't see that the new treatments that we're approving, like the FDA has approved a lot of drugs in the more than 35 agents in the last 2 years, they are benefiting the patients today tremendously. And of course, the statistics will take time. And don't worry about doing Google or things like that, because that may not be exactly with the situation that it is. You know, now we know for a fact that, for example, the breast cancer patient, stage 4 metastatic, the worst prognosis, he can live years with very good quality of life if she gets the proper therapy.
That is heartening for sure. I remember when stage 4 metastatic breast cancer diagnosis was essentially a death sentence. You're saying that, even though maybe the outcome still today no longer has the inevitability that it used to have.
Yes, that's correct. So, of course, there are subsets of breast cancer, like the famous triple negative, not the one that don't have markers, that have a more difficult survival. But now, for example, we tackle this with immunotherapy, target therapy, new weapons that we didn't have 10 years ago. So that's why the patients can have hope and survival. Also, another thing that we like to do in Florida, I'm talking about the president of the Professor of Oncology, we have a lot of cancer centers with research that will give you drugs that are not available in the market. So it's very important that the patients sign for these research studies so they can have access to therapy that is not in the market yet.
Thank you, Doctor. Terlisa Shepherd, tell us your cancer story here and what led you to write that book.
Well, Tom, my cancer story goes way back, and I'm very happy about that. I was actually 8.5 months pregnant when I was first diagnosed in 1998. So, and that was November 5th, so almost 1 month. I will be a 23-year survivor and almost 20 years of metastatic breast cancer. And you had mentioned with not having longevity with metastatic breast cancer, I actually was written off, and that was 20 years ago. So we, you know that a lot of things have changed during that time. But 20 years ago, I was told to go home, quit work, and get my life in order. And that's when I co-authored a book, Unbreakable Spirits, Rising Above the Impossible. And that was to encourage and motivate other cancer survivors that are going through this journey. And, you know, I would be on some type of treatments for the rest of my life, but, you know, thankful for research and all that we have going forward, we are hoping for a better outcome than 20 years ago.
Well, congratulations on each and every one of those anniversaries. Hard fought and hard won, Terlisa. But you brought up something here that maybe Megan Hall can help us out with here. Again, before breast cancer gets to stage 4 and starts to metastasize and cause even more devastation in someone, the entire concept of early detection is paramount. Talk about what you do in that regard, especially the latest developments that you have available.
Absolutely. So we know that early cancer detection saves lives. So when a cancer is detected at early stages before it has spread, nearly 9 out of 10 people will live to 5 years or longer. However, when cancer is detected at later stages, so after the cancer has spread or metastasized, that survival drops to only 2 out of 10 people living 5 years or longer. So we know that early detection is absolutely critical to improving survival rates. The tricky part is that we only have recommended screening tests for 5 cancers in the United States today. One of those is breast cancer, as we're discussing today. Colorectal cancer is another. Prostate cancer, cervical cancer, and then in a subset of high-risk patients, they're screening for lung cancer. What that means is there is no recommended screening test for the vast majority of cancer types. So patients tend to present to their healthcare provider when they have symptoms, which means the cancer is late stage and much harder to treat and much harder to cure. Survival is worse. And so there's a great need for a screening test that can complement the existing screening tests, not replace. And that's exactly what GRAIL is doing. So we've developed a test called Galleri that is a multi-cancer early detection test. It's a single blood test that can test for more than 50 different types of cancer and can predict where in the body that cancer is located, which can then help your healthcare provider direct your downstream diagnostic workup. And so we're hopeful that this will be a new tool in the arsenal against the war on cancer and really help to detect a broad number of cancer types, including breast cancer, at earlier stages when we know that they're more curable.
Is Galleri still undergoing testing now, Megan, or are you ready to roll out and go commercial? What's the situation?
So the good news is that the Galleri test has been launched. So you can get Galleri through a prescription from your healthcare provider. So your physician, nurse practitioner, physician's assistant. It's recommended for use in patients at risk of cancer, at an elevated risk of cancer. For example, patients who are at least 50 years of age or older tend to be at 13 times higher risk for developing cancer. Age is unfortunately the biggest risk factor for cancer. And so it is available again through prescription through your healthcare provider. And so we encourage people to talk to your healthcare provider about whether this test might be right for you.
Okay. Let's check in with Dr. Dunn just to get a reaction on that. Would such a test have made things easier for you when you were in the clinical setting back in Panama City, doctor? Or?
So I've actually been out of the clinic now 5 years, in Congress, and I am so impressed with the advances in diagnostics, early diagnostics, but diagnostics in general, and therapeutics. And Dr. Reyes was quite right when he said earlier they can do things now they couldn't do 5 or 10 years ago. We didn't even dream about some of this stuff, and so I'm excited when I get a chance to see some of the new developments. I've been following the blood test, the for early detection, what they call a wet biopsy, looking for a variety of different cancers. And they started out looking for just one at a time. You have a blood test to look for early prostate or blood test to look for early breast. And now they're looking at, an array of tests they can do on a single blood draw. And that's fascinating. I would like to know from Megan what the coverage. Okay, so it's good to have the test, but is it covered by the insurance? And if it's not, what's it cost?
So that's a really critical question. Right now, the test is not covered by insurance, but we have teams that are working with both public and private payers to ensure that the test will be covered in the future. Additionally, we are working with the FDA to get approval of the test. So we've received breakthrough device designation, which we understand will help with the coverage situation. But we absolutely recognize the importance of coverage so that we can ensure access to a very broad population and get this out to as many patients as possible as soon as possible. The cost of the test, if you're going to pay out of pocket, is going to be about $950. That will also depend on your specific healthcare provider or health system, which may have a different price. But there's more information if you'd like to dig into the details on www.galleri.com. That's galleri.com. We're really excited about these amazing technological advances. I'm honored to be a part of this. This is kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity, I think, to really shift the cancer mortality curve.
Well, so that's a great point. So you have insurance companies and government stepping on the brake on these great breakthroughs on detection and treatment, while scientists and clinicians are stepping on the gas to try to bring them in. I get it that you can't have just a gas or a brake on this thing, but I, right now I find that there's more obstruction in the government and in the insurance industry than there is gas helping to diagnose and treat patients early. An example of that is our current pandemic crisis. So we actually can test for immunity to SARS-CoV-2 virus, very specifically, very sensitively, very accurately. And those tests the government is literally ignoring. And I will tell you that there's a group of us in the government, and the DOC caucus would be sort of the center of that, agitation, where we are pushing them to start doing these immune testing. And Dr. has mentioned immune therapies. Well, you know, an immune therapy started out on infectious pathogens. And one of those would be SARS-CoV-2. And we know that that's a T cell mediated immunity, not antibody mediated immunity, but we're running around testing on the antibodies willy-nilly at great cost to the government. Nobody's really wants to take a look under the sheets at the T cell immunity, which is where it's primarily mediated. And so we have a $220 test you can get to tell if you're immune. All these people, we say, are you vaccinated? That's the wrong question. We should say, are you immune? Again, we can answer that question very, very accurately. And I use that as a metaphor for the early cancer testing, because we went through the same thing with cancer, where, you know, people are tapping the brake. We don't want to see all these cancers. And this is why, you know, we really know how to stratify that information much more intelligently. We don't go out and blow out the bank chasing down non-significant, non-clinically significant cancers. And I think that there's these the blood-based assays are great. I think there's some radiographic imaging tests that are outstandingly sensitive. You know, I started PET scanning. I was one of the first urologists in the country to start using PET scanning widely. And we found so many incidental cancers. You know, we were looking for, you know, urological cancers, kidney and prostate a lot of the time, but we found all kinds of things. And it was really shocking when you start looking at people in depth, how many things that you see.
Well, let's bring in Dr. Reyes there. What's your thoughts on that, sir?
No, I totally agree with both of you. For example, I'm proud to say this is a real example. You know, I work for the Memorial Healthcare System. We are the public healthcare system in Florida. We are a charter of the government in Florida. And we know about Galleri because we have been trying to get the test for our patients. And we are very, I'm not here to advertise, you know. It's like we are getting a much lower price thanks to arrangements, you know, because we represent the people here. We're the public healthcare system. There are no shareholders here. Our only interest is to have the test available for our patients. And also, I am a cancer researcher. So we have a second agreement with the company, with Grail. We are going to keep doing research to validate the results of the test. So hopefully, with the results of this research and all the research that they are doing nationwide, we can expedite the approval of the test. In that way, the payers can pay for the test, you know, because now we're in the middle of, as Neil said, we have a good test and nobody wants to pay. So we are trying to now, thanks to the research, we want to make this accessible to our patients soon. And we are very grateful that we are getting some other facilities that we can allow us to have the test accessible here in South Florida.
How did you, Terlisa Shepherd, how did you find out 20 years ago that you had breast cancer? Was it, you felt a lump, there were some secondary symptoms? How did you find out?
Actually, Tom, I found out that I had breast cancer through my pregnancy. I was seeing my gynecologist at the time, and the lump under my arm was getting bigger along with the pregnancy. And I kept voicing my opinion about that. And, you know, for some reason it fell through the cracks and it was felt that it was clogged milk ducts. And months had gone by until we got to about 8.5 months. And, you know, my doctor at the time, well, if you insist, we'll do a mammogram now and we'll do one after the fact to compare the two. And I was only 31 years old at that time. So again, you know, 23 years ago, that was unheard of. And I was one of the first cases in the Central Florida location. So it became all hands on deck when I was diagnosed. And it's like, you know, we got to check on a baby, we unborn baby, we got to do this, we got to do that. And as you can imagine, everything was all over the place, but I am grateful that my medical team got in and took care of me. And, you know, four diagnoses later, I'm still fighting the cause.
What was the...
Tom, can I call attention to something she said?
Sure.
She said her age was 31. Okay, so the Preventive Services Task Force actually came out with a recommendation a few years ago that women under 40 not only shouldn't be screened for breast cancer, they should not examine their own breasts for breast cancer or lumps. That was a recommendation by the government. That is an appallingly irresponsible recommendation. And I don't know how many women were pushed off like that, like Teresa was with her diagnosis. How could we suggest that young women in their 30s should not even examine their own breasts? That's just an amazing thing to me. And I say that because we need to be cautious. The government does try to help, but sometimes it doesn't help as much as you would like.
Well, and you do have organizations like the American Cancer Society and some other NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are kind of pushing in the other direction on that, or at least taking the lead when it comes to the recommendations for what should and perhaps should not be going on. Are they perhaps, I don't know, Congressman, a more reliable source of information sometimes? And I don't know what, the CDC or...
They have a thing called regulatory capture here, you know, where sometimes the well-meaning organizations, and I hold up the AUA, the American Urological Association, since I'm a member and a fan of the work they do, they fought back against the Preventive Services Task Force, but only with moderate success in the case of prostate cancer. And I like Megan made the note that there's only five cancers that we recommend screening for, a few more that the insurance companies will back up, like dermatologic cancers. But we really are still in the early, early days of getting this recognized as efficient, effective care that should be part of our routine screening care.
Dr. Ruiz, you jumped in. Go ahead.
Yeah, part of the screening problem is that the harm that we can do to the patients, you know, as you know, with the screening, we find the minority of the screened individuals have cancer. So that's why years ago, for example, it was very painful when the USPSD task force said, oh, we don't need to screen ladies below 50, stop screening at 40. Now we're only going to screen above 50 because it's too much money that we're spending between 40 and 50. There is something right. No, yeah, we are doing a lot of mammograms, biopsies, exposing the ladies to radiation, because there are very few that have cancer. So the solution is to find a test. That's what we like. I'm a researcher for liquid biopsies, blood tests, because we have to find better ways to test the people without exposing, for example, to radiation. My expertise is lung cancer. The only thing I can recommend for screening today is if you are smoking above 50, we need to do a CAT scan. And why I want to expose people to CAT scans once a year, if I can find a blood test or something. That's why part of the problem now, and you know the story of prostate cancer very well, that they don't want to recommend anymore, is because we do a lot of unnecessary test procedures, spending money, because we don't have the right ways to find the cancer early yet. You know, and in the case of breast cancer, it's amazing. If you are at stage one, pretty much we cure everybody. If you get to stage four, we cure only one every three. That's why I think that we are a strong advocate of new screening methods, better than radiology, that are still cost effective and don't expose the patient to unnecessary toxicity.
If I can just
go ahead,
on.
Megan. Yeah, I was about to check in with you anyway. Go ahead.
Perfect. So you're hitting on a really important point, Dr. Reyes, and that's the performance characteristics of the different kinds of tests. So those single cancer tests, like mammography, PSA screening for prostate cancer, those are really designed to optimize the number of cancers you can detect, and they tolerate a much higher false positive rate. These multi-cancer early detection tests are designed differently, so they're really minimizing the number of false positives. Our test and other tests that are following us very quickly all have a very, very low false positive rate of less than 1%. which really means that not a lot of patients are going to be subjected to unnecessary follow-up procedures. And I think that's really, really critical when you're rolling this out on a population scale. The last thing we want to be doing is sending a lot of patients into the healthcare system unnecessarily for, as you note, potentially harmful follow-up procedures. The other thing I wanted to point out is just to revisit the overdiagnosis comment that I think is part of the issue with prostate cancer screening and why it has been so controversial. And that's that overdiagnosis is detecting more indolent cancers that may not need treatment or as aggressive treatment. And one of the really groundbreaking things about these multi-cancer early detection tests, not just our test, but any test that's leveraging the DNA that's in your bloodstream, is that there's a biological driver of detection, and that's the aggressiveness of the tumor. So these tumors are shedding DNA into the bloodstream, and more aggressive tumors are shedding more DNA. That makes them more detectable by our assay and by other assays that are using cell-free DNA. And what that means is that this test not only has a low false positive rate, but that it's also really not likely to be subject to overdiagnosis the same way some of the more traditional screens might be. That said, I want to emphasize again, there's huge benefit to the existing screens, so everybody should continue to get your recommended screening, please. But as an add-on to the recommended screening, I think these multi-cancer early detection tests offer a really huge opportunity.
But I'm going to jump in on Megan's comment here because I think she's absolutely right. You know, what the and just to put it, to kind of punctuate why that's valuable. You know, you can do a PSA test for $9.50. And then if it's positive, looks positive, you put them through this multi-cancer detection array. It's more expensive, but it's also very, very non-invasive and very, very sensitive and specific. So, I mean, what you're doing is you've got sort of layered screening tests. Okay, this test, you look suspicious on, the next one, you're okay. And all that without sticking needles in you, which I stuck needles in a lot of people in my career, but I don't like them, and I don't like to do that. Stuck in me either. And if I take one more of those brain biopsies for COVID, I think I'm just going to scurry.
Well, maybe back to you, Megan. Can you walk us through process here? Because we all know that anything is more efficacious if it is affordable and it is in widespread use. So how do you get this particular type of test into consideration by insurance companies so that it becomes more readily available to the people who need it?
Sure. Really important question. And I think, you know, the best way that we can get this into consideration by the insurance providers is to have as robust validation as we can. We have a huge, huge clinical genomics program at Grail. It's really one of the largest clinical genomics programs that is in existence today in genomic medicine. Hundreds of thousands of patients enrolling to our studies, including at a number of centers in Florida specifically. And so that, coupled with getting approval through the regulatory agency, which we are actively working on, we have breakthrough device designation from the FDA, which is a huge step in the right direction. We are actively engaged with the regulators. I think that will really help get these tests approved and reimbursed in a timely fashion. That said, because we recognize the importance of getting this into the population's hands as soon as possible, because we want earlier detection, we want to save lives, we went ahead and launched it as what's called a lab developed test while we continue to work on regulatory approval with the FDA.
We're talking about Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which is all October here on Perspectives on WFSU Public Media, and our all-star panel talking about the detection of breast cancer. And we're about to embark on talking a little bit about the treatment facet of this particular disease. A reminder, if you miss all or part of a Perspectives program, they are available for you online at our WFSU.org website. We try to have the most recent program that you hear on the radio archived on the website as soon as possible, actually, after it airs. Terlisa Shepherd, talk about your treatment 20 years ago initially for that first diagnosis of breast cancer. Once you got that horrible, soul-shattering news. What happened next?
So, Tom, when I got my news, I, of course, had to deliver my baby 6 weeks early. And because I had a stage 3 aggressive type tumor, it was already 3.5 centimeters in size. I had to get started on chemotherapy treatments right away. And I went for the, basic breast cancer treatments for my subtype of breast cancer, HER2 positive, and went through all of that radiation and surgery and started back to work. And just 2 years later, I was re-diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, where it metastasized to my bones, lungs, and liver. And just the very next year, it metastasized to my abdomen and spine. And another year later, to my brain. So I have all of these metastatic sites that I will be on some type of treatments for the rest of my life. And that's why, I advocate for more research and finding out these great opportunities that we can shape for breast cancer before it gets to a later stage as mine was.
Dr. Reyes, those are still the indicated treatments of choice, though, for many kinds of cancers, including breast cancer, though, that double whammy of radiation and chemotherapy, or in the case of, some tumors, actual surgery. This is how we've been doing it. This is how we'll continue to do it, do you think?
No, because now, as I said, not only breast cancer, but in all the cancers, we have two different treatments. One is what we call precision medicine, is that we have to start to discover that each cancer is a family. It's a family of different genes that have mutated. So now we are identifying what is the gene that causes your breast cancer, your lung cancer, your colon cancer, and we're engineering drugs that kill the gene or inactivate the gene. That's what we call precision medicine. And the second thing is we have immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is an infusion that we give you that enhances your immune system and puts your immune system where we're supposed to be. You're not supposed to get cancer because the immune system is supposed to clean the cancer as soon as the cancer arises. But for some reason, your immune system is not working well, so the cancer is growing in your body. So the immunotherapy restitutes your immune system, and the immunotherapy empowers you to kill the cancer. Immunotherapy is already approved for more than 30 or 35 cancers in the United States, and it's doing very well. And of course, we're only in the beginning. So what we're doing, in other words, as a summary, we are starting to replace chemotherapy for more rational and less toxic interventions like immunotherapy or the target agent, the pills, because for each gene that we're destroying, I mentioned we are using a pill. It's an oral drug that you can stay home and you don't have to come to see us. So we are in the process to improve these options for the patient. So one day we can stop doing chemotherapy and maybe we don't have to do so much radiation therapy because there are a lot of long-term effects on the patients of this intervention.
Can I expand on Dr. Reyes's comments just a bit to simplify him a bit? He's in the clinic all the time. He's got all these bright people around him. I have to talk to Congressman. Let me see if I can make that a little clearer for everybody else. When he talked about personalized therapies, he said, you actually do a genotype on the cancer cells, not on the person cells, on the cancer cells. And you may find that this cancer, let's just say it's a prostate cancer, but it has a gene that we associate with melanoma, a skin cancer. And it has a pathway there in the prostate that looks like melanoma pathway that you can use a melanoma drug in the prostate to cure that patient or make headway with them. And that's the advantage of precision medicine. You're no longer just studying the lung, the prostate, or breast. You're studying genetic pathways and markers that you can actually precision target things in a cancer, no matter where the heck the cancer started. That was one thing I wanted to expand on because it's very, very cool. And by the way, totally different model than we were brought up on. Prostate is prostate, stomach is stomach, liver is liver, and you treated them differently. And you had to go through the litany of clinical tests to prove it in each cancer. We're getting much smarter than that. The other thing is in the immunotherapy, immunotherapy for the first 20 years, it was always the it was always the therapy that was going to be just 3 years away. And it was 3 years away, 3 years away. Now I think it's here. I think we could do some great things with immunotherapy. We finally are getting to the point where we can make a real difference in people with immunotherapy. And I am amazed and pleased and you know, kudos to all my colleagues who've done this this brilliant work. I was mostly a surgeon. You know, man, you're putting us out of business. Good for you.
Well, I think you may know this guy, a cancer surgeon based in Tallahassee, Congressman, a guy by the name of Jeff Crooms. I had a long chat with him when my wife was coming off of her first breast cancer diagnosis, and he was essentially railing at what was then the existing therapies for handling it. And he said, you know, you have to use a chainsaw to do this microsurgery. And it just, he was just frothing at the mouth. He was so upset. And as these technologies became more commonplace, I noticed he's calmed down a great deal. So I think I know what you're talking about there.
Yeah, there's always going to be obviously a place for sure. Maybe not always, but there will be for a lot longer time for surgery and cancer. We joked, we used to say a chance to cut is a chance to cure, but that was self-selecting. I mean, because we would only do surgery on something or cancer we thought we could get around. If it was past what we could get around, metastatic, as poor Ms. Shepherd was on her presentation day, you know, the surgery, you can add some things, but nobody thinks you're curing a cancer that spread like that with surgery alone. That isn't going to happen.
Megan Hall, as we move forward here past the Galeri protocol that you folks are working on right now over at Grail, what do you see as the future for diagnostic tools to build upon what's already here? Or do you see maybe even some more revolutionary things out there in the pipeline somewhere?
Yeah, I think our efforts right now are very focused on ensuring adoption of these technologies on a really broad scale. That said, 5-10 years ago, I never would have predicted we'd be here where we are with the Galleri test. We've had some really incredible advances in sequencing technologies and artificial intelligence that have facilitated the development of the Galleri test. That's not to say there won't be similar advances that I can't predict in the next 5-10 years as well. We might be able to catch cancers at the first cell. As there's a book by a woman named Dr. Azra Raza called The First Cell that's a fabulous read that talks about how we need to get ahead of this cancer detection. And so as technologies advance, I wouldn't be surprised if we see smaller and smaller amounts of cancer being able to be detected. And I think that's absolutely the direction we're going with these multi-cancer early detection tests.
And Dr. Reyes, that also means less and less expense that has to be directed towards the healing of cancer as we have more of these kinds of tools that Megan talked about and that you just referenced when it comes to immunotherapy and the more targeted kinds of treatments than the old-fashioned, we're going to club it to death with chemo and radiation.
No, that's what we call in precision medicine, you know, because for example, in the past, we used to give chemotherapy for 100 patients, and we know that only works in 25. So 75 patients were getting unnecessary chemotherapy and getting exposure that is ruining their quality of life. Now with the pills that I mentioned, in a lung cancer patient, if we can find a gene called EGFR, the pill that there are 5 pills approved in America, oral agents, and they give you a 75% response. So we have totally switched it. Now 75% of the patients will respond to the pill because they have the gene. And it's only a matter of time that we go from 75 to 100 because there are some glitches that we have to discover. So that's why that's what we call precision medicine. But something important that you are saying that is we need to test the patient because otherwise they are not going to get the benefit. So that's why it's very important, even in Florida, our amount of testing level for cancer biomarkers is only 50%. So that's why a lot of doctors don't keep track of these new developments, and sometimes they are slow to test. And we don't need to test for one gene. We have, in lung cancer only, we have 10 genes already with FDA-approved oral agents. So if you want these patients to take these oral agents for lung cancer and avoid chemo, you need to find the genes, and the only way to find it during the testing. That's why there is a lot to catch up, and I appreciate the opportunity that you guys give us in media to talk about this, educate the community, and especially it's very important that Mr. Shepherd is here, because we have to empower the patient. The patient has to go to his first visit by saying, I want my biomarker testing. Why are you going to start treatment? So that's the best way that we can help each other to get a better cancer care. And as I said, I would love to, before I die, get rid of chemo forever and give a better chance, a better treatment for the patient, you know?
Talisa Shepherd, that sounds like it would make your ongoing battle with the disease maybe a little bit less stressful than what has come before.
Absolutely. But Tom and Dr. Reyes, I must say, I've been on an immunotherapy treatment since 2001. And as you can see, it has worked wonders for me. So, you know, I'm hoping that I don't have to worry about my other arsenals that's coming up next. But for almost 20 years, immunotherapy has been an ace for me.
While we're talking to you, Talisa, talk a little about your book, Unbreakable Spirit Rising Above the Impossible.
Well, I started writing that book right in the middle of my diagnosis. And I finished up and also knew that I had to continue on in my advocacy. I use that as somewhat of an advocacy to get started in my community, because I actually grew up in a very rural community in Alabama, and I knew how important we needed someone to speak up for others. It was, the nearest cancer center was like at least an hour away. And if you're having problems with trying to get transportation, or in my case, now I'm only 15 minutes from my cancer center. I can drive myself down and be there in 15 minutes. That's not the case in rural communities. So what are you up against? Maybe not even going for certain appointments, at very important appointments that you need. And things like that we need to have a better handle on.
Congressman Dunn, yeah, I wanted to throw it to you, because we're seeing so many issues, as you know, in rural America right now, where hospitals and other facilities are shutting down. They can't make it. So what do you do from, you know, the government's viewpoint?
You know, and it's not just rural America anymore either, Tom. So Dr. Reyes said that he was wishing people would adopt earlier, and I get that totally. But I will tell you that the entire American medical system is under much more pressure than it ever has, from several different angles. And even before the pandemic, we were showing some cracks in the structure here. You know, we have an aging demographic in medicine. We have a shortage, oddly enough, of doctors. And you think that there's a lot of people who want to be doctors, but there are not a lot of residency slots for doctors. So we don't train them. We can get them. We fixed the number of medical school seats, but America actually produces more graduating medical students than it has residency slots to train them in at this point in time. And those are expensive. You got to hire those, what we call graduate medical education doctors, GMEs, residents, and we're not producing the residents. And then when they get out into practice, they are frequently not incentivized to work as hard to keep up or stay in there or take some of the tougher specialties like Dr. Reyes's, because you know, reimbursement isn't there, and they come out with these huge student debts. And so there's a lot of pressure on medicine right now, and it's not really working as well as it used to. And the pandemic didn't help. You know, now that we have that, we have not only all of the pressures that were on the personnel, on the reimbursements, and on the coverage, you all of a sudden, you have people distracted, as we saw in the number of screenings for breast cancer, colon, lung, everything, cancers just dropped through the floor, the number of them, during the pandemic. So those are all cancers that are fast. They're still happening. They just haven't been detected. And they're waiting out there to get Dr. Reyes, keep him busy for the rest of his life, I'm afraid, you know, and as metastatic cases. So there's a lot of bad things going on. And I'm going to add to the fact that I pick up the paper every day and there's another hospital firing its staff because they haven't had a vaccine. I'm just not sure that's a very productive attitude. And let me give a plug here to Governor DeSantis in his program to to make vaccine mandates wrong. There's a lot of reasons why that's a bad idea, but you know, fundamentally, it's an overreaction to this pandemic, and it's a dysfunctional reaction. It's not just over. It's whoa. There are reasons to be concerned about that as well, and so I would like to see us return to a much more holistic approach to providing medical care, providing medical education, and taking care of our hospital personnel. All right. That's my comment. Right now, the system is breaking. It's not getting better. It's breaking.
Okay. And Dr. Reyes, what are you seeing at your level there as far as not only the need for personnel, but reluctance for people to come in and have any kind of diagnostic procedures done? Because, again, fear of COVID.
Yeah, we did the extra mile, you know, during the last 2 years of COVID, we haven't closed the cancer center one single day. Even in the worst times, you know, we send all the personnel home and only the doctors were here. But we keep the cancer center open because we have patients on treatment. And at the same time, that give opportunity for the other patients to come, and that didn't happen. So that's why last year, nationwide, there was a decrease around 45%. In the new cancer diagnosis in colon, breast, lung, because a lot of patients didn't come. And as the congressman is saying, we need now to catch up, you know, and the problem is in some cancers, a 6 month delay in lung cancer is you're already close to be a stage four. And by that time, 6 months later, you are for sure stage four. Unfortunately, you know, these cancers grow too fast and they are unnoticed. But even in breast cancer too, because, you know, we are very lucky that, as I mentioned before, 99% of the stage one breast cancers survive now. But of course, not if the tumors keep growing and you don't come to your mammogram. So, and you know, because you're afraid or the hospital is closed, because sometimes also we cannot blame the patients. A lot of healthcare systems here in Florida, they shut down because they don't have the resources to keep the cancer center open and to keep taking COVID care in the hospital. Fortunately, we didn't have to do that. But I know that a lot of healthcare systems had limitations in the number of offices, and now we are in a great need of nurses, employees. In the last 6 months have been very hard. We have tons of positions open in the hospitals because we don't have enough people to work. So that's why it has been a fight, but as I said, we are telling the patients to please come, don't delay. This is very serious. The best way to kill cancer is by prevention and not treating stage four. So.
And if patients have any doubt about the efficacy of that advice, Terlisa Shepherd, they need only check in with you because you're one of the strongest advocates when it comes to that. When you have family members or other folks you know who say, you know, I just don't want to know. I'm afraid that if I go and I have it checked out, I will get bad news and I can't handle bad news. What do you tell them?
I've had actually people to tell me that they did not want to know, and they had symptoms of something going on. And I tell them, you know, why not go get checked? If we decide to wait to a later date and go get checked, then if by chance that you're diagnosed, it's at a later stage. And then you have to worry about maybe possibly getting treated for the rest of your life, but also more aggressive type of treatments. And Dr. Reyes, as you presented, you know, I'm so very happy that my cancer center didn't close or shut down during the pandemic, because being metastatic, I will be on some type of treatments for the rest of my life. And I did miss one treatment during the pandemic, but I carried on. And unfortunately, I did find some brain swelling where I had to have a craniotomy surgery right in the middle of the pandemic. So I'm one of those patients that are very grateful that we are able to carry on with some type of treatments for our cancer diagnosis.
That is just an amazing story. I really appreciate you being part of this today. And I wanted to give you and the rest of the panel just a moment to kind of any final thoughts that you might have before we wrap it up today.
Yeah, so I really appreciate the chance to listen to Ms. Shepherd here today. You know, she sounds like she'd be a great patient to care for, by the way. Not all patients are compliant with, you know, the plan. And she sounds like she sticks with it like a religion. So congratulations to you. That's important for a lot of these therapies to work. And I want to say also that, you know, people, you know, and we fight this. They say, I don't want to know about it. I'm going to die anyways. Well, second, everybody's going to die. Nobody gets out of this life alive. But, you know, if I used to get people men with metastatic, mostly prostate cancer, my specialty, who come in and, you know, they never came to me with the very easy stuff. I was the end of the road, right? And I said, okay, guys, okay, if I can give you 10 good years from now, and these are guys typically in their 60s, sometimes 50s, sometimes older, you know, 10 more good years, are we okay with each other here? And then we'll see what happens in 10 years. Maybe Dr. Raz will invent something better. You know, that's a good message for people, you know, and they liked that. They like say 10 years. Okay. I thought I was dying. No, you know, tomorrow is promised to no one. So we ought to be taking care of each other. The loss of human potential and value by failing to treat people early and when we can with what we can, you know, that's a real, some people use the term human capital. You know, that's kind of a cold hearted term. People are worth something. They are worth things. And they're a lot better if we keep them healthy and alive.
Thanks so much, Congressman. Megan Hall, just very quickly, any final thoughts from you?
Sure. Just would encourage all of your listeners to go get their recommended screening tests. It is so important to be detected early and get treated as early as you can if you are diagnosed. And if you would like any more information about GRAIL or the Galleri test, you can visit www.galleri.com. That's Galleri with an I.
Okay. And we'll wrap up with you, Dr. Luis Reyes.
I think the most important is the screening. We need to detect cancers early. It's cost effective, less pain and suffering for the patient. That doesn't have to endure treatment for years. And there is a lot to do. You know, you will be surprised how low are some screening rates. For example, in lung cancer nationwide, only 4% of the patients need to be screened are screened. And colon cancer, same thing. We are only in the 70%. So there's still a lot of people that need to be screened. And then wait with hope, because there are better screening tests coming soon.
Dr. Luis Reyes, president of the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, joined by Megan Hall, senior director of medical communications at GRAIL, which is pioneering the Galleri multi-cancer early detection system. Teresa Shepherd, metastatic breast cancer survivor. Congratulations. And Dr./Congressman Neil Dunn of Florida's 2nd Congressional District. Thank you all for being part of this October Breast Cancer Awareness Month special on Perspectives, produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Thanks to Taylor Cox, Paul Dam, Brandon Brown, Tricia Moynihan, and Lydell Rawls, our director of content, Kim Kelling, executive producer. I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, leaders of the Holocaust Education Resource Center will stop on by to talk about several upcoming events and initiatives they have cooking. We'll talk about it all right here on Perspectives. Take care.